You're listening easy to smooth sailing with your captain, Jackson Scanberg, only on WJEB Radio, Milwaukee's finest classic country music, with special guest,
welcome to Smooth Sailing 2. Another year of smooth sailing. It's a beautiful night out in Milwaukee. The sun is still up. The noon's not quite there. Actually, it is there. We just can't see it yet. And today, for our season opener, we have Mr. John Fung on. John, are you there? John is here, however, I cannot hear him. He is unmuted, but he is not saying anything. John Fung is having technical difficulties at this moment.
Hello. The server is on push to talk. I was not aware.
Oh, it appears John Fung has gotten it working because the entire server's on push to talk, and I was not aware of this either because I am not using push to talk, so I have no idea what you mean.
I was just given permissions that disabled push to talk, it seems. But yes, hello, I'm happy to be here.
Mr. Fung, what do you think about the weather we've had lately in Milwaukee?
I think it's been perfect Summerfest weather. Let me tell you, Water Street never goes quiet.
And what do you think of that mysterious day earlier in the week where the sky literally got as dark as night?
Yeah, well, you know, maybe that day wasn't the Summerfest day. I'm sure my grandparents were not smiling, but I think the rest of the days have been great.
I agree. Mr. Fung, you go to the Milwaukee School of Engineering, is that correct?
That is correct.
And what do you study at the Milwaukee School of Engineering?
I am proud to study computer science. I used to be a software engineer, but then I realized the error of my ways.
I didn't know that. You used to be software?
I did, yeah. When I was coming in, actually, I declared software engineering, and then realized that I enjoyed AI just a little bit more than the engineering, quote-unquote, curriculum of an SE.
Which is mostly just what is the software curriculum? Did you get to see any of it?
Even if I hadn't switched until now, the first years are very similar. I was just referring to more the more engineering process classes. Think like requirements and specifications, like design principles, for example. All of which are important, don't get me wrong, but I enjoyed just the AI and the machine learning aspect a little more.
I see. So, what is the real difference? I mean, you keep mentioning the difference between how much more you enjoy machine learning and AI over the typical software engineering gig, but what is the typical software engineering gig? If you could lean us a little bit more into that, if you have any clue of what that is.
Yeah, well, obviously I didn't do it myself, but from what I was told anyway, the freshman year is basically exactly the same. You take your gen eds, you take freshman studies, you take your basic software development classes, and your sophomore year is also pretty much, it diverges a little, but it's also pretty similar. What changes is when you get to the junior and senior years. In the junior year, for computer science anyway, you start diverging into the focus on AI, machine learning, data science, while in software engineering, you start studying the software engineering process, requirements and specification, design and architecture, and then you start the senior software development laboratory, which is like a project that you do that isn't your senior design project. It's like a smaller project to prepare you for that. So, yeah, I mean, I think it's more engineering. Like, if you were to ask an ME what engineering is, you know, they would tell you about design and specifications and all that, and that's not something that CS has, but, you know, focuses on something else.
Mm-hmm. And what do you think of Mechies as a member of the greatest department, the EECS department yourself?
I would prefer if I did not think of Mechies.
Fair enough. How old are you, Mr. Fong, if you would like to disclose that? This can be a true or false statement.
I am 19. I am currently a sophomore as we record this. My birthday is over the summer, so I'm usually young for my class.
Mm-hmm. And what has it been like growing up in the 21st century, Mr. Fung? In one word, how would you describe it?
I don't know if I can do it in a word, but it's been tough. I think tough is an understatement.
Fair enough that it's been tough. Mr. Fung, what's your marital status?
My marital status? I am not married.
And what's your social security number, if you don't mind giving us that either?
Okay. All right. I don't know if I can give... Well, let me listen to an old episode, actually. I'm sure someone shared it.
No, but seriously, we're both RAs at the Milwaukee School of Engineering, and you have perhaps the uniquest floor by far, as in you are in the one floor that is not part of any other RA's assignments, which is Grohman Tower.
That I am, and I am eternally thankful for this assignment.
What do you think of Grohman Tower? I've only been in it a couple times. It seems like overwhelmingly the nicest place to live.
Oh, absolutely. And I mean, it's also the most expensive place to live, but, you know, you get what you pay for.
Not price per square foot, however.
Not price per square foot. Really?
Have you seen the spreadsheet?
I have not.
I believe one of our regular frequent viewers, in fact, the station owner of WJEB Radio, 101.1 FM, Milwaukee's Finest Country Radio, John Bilkey, has made a spreadsheet with a very, very, very outgoing RHA member by the name of Chris Imholt that has price per square foot of all living facilities around the MSOE campus. And Veats Tower and MLH are the worst, even compared to some of the high-end buildings very close to Pfizer.
Really?
Yes.
Wow. And we haven't, like, talked to ResLife about this?
No. If someone could post a link, I would appreciate that if it still exists. Oh, yep. Can you see in general?
Yeah, I see it. No.
What do you think of that?
Wow, that's, and that's even before the honor subsidized prices, too, so that's insane.
I mean, Comstock is dirt cheap.
Yeah. Yeah,
but
absolutely.
I mean, Comstock has more, is less than JVT, and JVT is a mess. It's like Regents, but worse than what I've been told.
Yeah, that's crazy. And of course they won't cut the cost because of the housing requirements. So, yeah, that totally makes sense. I'm doubly eternally thankful now that I've been placed here.
So, how's the floor been this year? I imagine it's pretty smooth being all honors kids compared to your average floor.
Oh, absolutely. And granted, not all of the students I RA live on my floor, so I'm not watching them 24/7. But so far, it's been pretty smooth. I heard that things were a little bit rougher last year, and I really hope that changes this year.
Are you speaking of a certain incident where many people got evicted?
Yeah, I possibly might be speaking to that.
Sorry, I had to switch audio for a second there. John's gonna kill me in post. Oh my god. Can you still hear me?
You're still alive.
Okay. My headphones are having issues. They are old. Very, very old. Very good. Anyways, continuing on with the discussion, we were talking about housing prices on campus and being an RA, and specifically the incident last year. Did you know anyone that got caught out in the incident?
I am aware of those that got caught out in the incident. I'm not certain I'm at liberty to share any more than that.
Fair enough. For those that don't know, like we said, there was a mass eviction due to a violation of COVID protocol. Which is kind of ironic because now they're keeping all the quarantine kids in Grohmann this year.
Rick, Mr. Gagliano, the building manager, mm-hmm. He takes the policy seriously.
Yes.
So I'm not particularly surprised by what happened, but I just hope it again.
Did you have to talk to Rick or make any contracts when you got hired? Was there anything additional you had to do that other RAs didn't because you're in Grohmann?
Not that I'm aware of. I guess besides signing a Grohmann lease, but that doesn't really matter. No, I mean, I talked to Rick. We had a discussion because since he's the building manager, he's also technically my boss.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, after the honors program last year, I think he trusts us, at least this year.
And what does the honors program do? How is it different from the regular programs at MSOE?
Oh, it's so very different. And a part of me wishes I had taken freshman studies just to know how to compare it, honestly. But you and I both know that I'm going to root for the honors program here.
Mm-hmm.
I guess before I can start the comparison, the honors program replaces, like, the normal freshman-sophomore track. Most freshmen take freshman seminar, which is freshman seminar 1, 2, and 3, which is a series of technical communication classes. You have to do things like rhetorical analysis, speeches, presentations, and the like. And that's all to make you a better engineer. And in some cases, it is totally necessary. And I don't blame them for having these technical communications classes, especially for the engineering majors.
Mm-hmm.
The honors program replaces that with honors seminar, which, before I continue, let me read off what they have on their website here. It combines experiential learning, real-world projects, and community service that allows you to explore innovative ideas, build relationships with classmates and community members, and complete projects that pair engineering skills with a healthy dose of creativity. Now, right off the bat, I mean, that description sounds a lot more interesting than what a freshman seminar has to offer. But, you know, that's the website, so what? However, from my experience, I believe I can wholeheartedly say that the honors program made me a much more well-rounded individual and provided an experience I think I could not have gotten anywhere else. You know, we had, you can get credit for freshman, or not freshman seminar specifically, but humanities credits for classes such as AP Language and Composition, AP Literature and Composition. But I really don't think you can replace what you learn in the honors program with just technical communication. So the first class, Honors Seminar 1, let me get it up on the catalog, actually.
What was any of the projects you did while you pull it up, if any
sure,
comes to mind?
Yeah. So, so you work on one main project throughout the year. You and a group of people get paired up in it with a community partner, as we call it, and you work with them throughout the year to give back to the community, really. I was paired up with Emilio De Torre, former president of the ACLU in Milwaukee, and a current president of the Turner Association, hosted in Turner Hall right near the Pfizer Forum. Yeah, so they're, I won't get into it because, you know, we had a whole year to work with them, but the Turners are, the Milwaukee Turners in particular, I should say, are a rich and storied branch of the Turner organization that was started in the 19th century, and they were all about, and they emphasized the principles of mind, body, and soul, having a sound mind through their discussions on issues such as social justice. A sound body with the rock climbing gym they provide at Turner Hall, and a sound soul through the arts such as the Turner Hall Ballroom, where they host events such as musical events. So I have it up now. The first the first class talks about exploring the city as text, learning to read the city and understanding the concept of the city. And more importantly, what is and is not the city. The first class had a strong emphasis on borders. Who is in, who is out, and who makes those rules? The second class goes into... I'm getting a little ahead of myself. When we talked about borders, we talked about some great examples of borders, both historically in the United States and throughout the world. For example, one of the first things we covered was the history of the United States, because we can't understand the modern day without history. We talked about, even from the 18th century, colonization, to today, we discussed the countless wars and atrocities that the United States committed, such as, take, for example, what happened with Native Americans, like the Trail of Tears. From there, moving on into the modernist era, we talked about discriminatory practices such as redlining and restrictive covenants, which disenfranchised many African-American people, for example.
Mm-hmm.
And then moving on to the modern era, we talked about how, what were the responses to those acts and how could we help to change them, both in the, both in policy and with place. So I've, you know, honestly, like trying to summarize it, I feel does not do it justice. And if you were to have Dr. Carrier, the program director on this show, he could explain it leagues better. But in any case, I feel, and I actually said this during the honors orientation during Welcome Week, but if you mm-hmm. ask me or any other honors student what they did in honors seminar, I guarantee you that it will be much more interesting than someone in freshman studies would have to say.
Maybe, but I tried to save birds. Have you heard of that story before?
I don't believe I have.
So, do you know about the many, many dead birds we find all over campus?
I'm aware.
In the greater Milwaukee area? Our goal, and we talked to former vice president of operations at MSOE, Kevin Marin, about this, was to get UV translucent tape up on windows, specifically around the science building and on the skywalk, that would work as it, let me back up a bit, to bird psychology, I guess, or behavioral studies. So studies have found that birds are able to identify gaps, as in they have naturally learned how to fly in between objects that they can sense are too small for them, they will avoid, and if the gap is too large, they can recognize it and fly through the gap. So what has been done on many buildings is putting UV translucent tape or just UV substances in the wall that traps incoming UV photons between the wall and the material of the glass, which is beyond my scientific understanding, to create a bar pattern that birds will recognize and identify that they cannot fly through and avoid windows and killing themselves.
We
talked to Kevin about it, and Kevin said, yes, great idea. We'll have it implemented. And then Kevin retired.
I understand. That's a shame. Now that you mention it, I did see a bird do that just this morning, in fact. So now it all makes sense.
Yeah. So unfortunately, the birds will continue to die until something is done by someone.
My condolences to the birds. We'll have to bring this up at the RHA meeting, I guess.
Maybe. Betty, the birds are dying. What do we do?
What are you doing, Mitch? Come on.
Yell at Steve Williams, the now promoted EECS department chair, who has taken Kevin's place. I never met Steve. I don't know if you have.
I cannot say I have. I wish I had.
Oh, Mr. Hendricks is typing. Oh, he seems like an all right guy, is what we have. By the way, I think it would be a good time to stop about half an hour in and go, does anyone have any questions for Mr. Fung about the honors program or any of the things he has said previously?
I haven't even talked about what I did.
Nope. Not yet.
Ah, darn it.
Just in general. We'll take that. We ask for questions, and we don't seem like we have any, so continue and tell us exactly what you did.
Oh, heck yeah. So like I said, my project was with the Milwaukee Turners and Emilio De Torre. The Honors Program actually has a website where all this is documented, but, you know, you can't see it. It would be very cool if you checked it out. In particular, my group and I worked with him to archive the history of the Milwaukee Turners. So, like I said, the Milwaukee Turners has a long and varied history starting from the 19th century It was actually during the 1850s when a large group of Germans were exiled for wanting democracy in Germany. Exiled, they came to the U.S. and they started the Turners, which relied on the sound mind, body, and soul principles. From there, however, at least to today, a lot of that history is just lying around in Turner Hall. There are books of photos that Emilio just did not know where they came from. There are books with physical membership cards, back when those were a thing, with names written in German that he can barely read. He wanted to help preserve what was left of the Milwaukee Turners, and to that end, I think we did a great job. Now, we weren't going to archive the entire history of the Milwaukee Turners in a year, not by any means. But to give you a sense of how important it was, the museum at UW-Milwaukee actually has many artifacts from the Turners, and Turner Hall is in the National Registry of Historic Places. Mm-hmm. So what we were doing, definitely, even if it doesn't sound historic, I guess, maybe you had to be there to understand, but it definitely was historic, and a lot of people would agree. So we did a lot of work regarding transcribing membership cards to create a database of Turner members to help to create the relationships between current and past Turner members and hopefully develop future Turner members. Besides that, the Turners had a lot of old physical media that they just did not have access to. Think CDs, DVDs, there were even Walkman cassettes and 8mm film.
Okay.
Yeah. So we worked... Oh, yes.
Yeah, is there a link to this website that you could drop, or this database that you created? Is that something that you have?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Let me get the Honors website up.
You could drop it in the general chat of the WJEB Radio 101.1 FM Discord. And from there, Mr. Bilkey can put it on our website when the episode actually goes up in the ideas section things. Ah, there it is right there.
There it is, yes.
So did you do any transcribing of these CDs and Walkman tapes to digital media?
Yeah, we did. So we actually work with Brian Hochstetler of Howell Street Recording, one of Dr. Carrier's connections. And he helped us. The CDs and the DVDs were the easy part, right?
Yeah.
The Walkmans were a little harder, and I believe we're still... Well, by the end of the year, I believe Dr. Carrier was still working with him to get those 8mm film onto digital.
Mm-hmm.
So certainly, you know, certainly it was going to be a long process, and... We weren't expected, like, my grade did not depend on transcribing all of these tapes by the end of the year or anything. But what we were able to transcribe, I think, was interesting, I guess, to say the very least. I mean, there was just so much rich history behind it that I feel like you would need to go to the website to really, truly capture. I don't know if I can explain in words.
Mm-hmm.
I guess, for example, there were some old... One of the recordings we found was actually an old advertisement for Turner Hall. They were advertising an event with the Turner Hall Ballroom. I believe it was going to be a jazz concert. So, I mean, just... going back to a time before COVID, I guess.
What time in specific? Could you, like, pinpoint a decade? Or was this more of a, we found this and we had to kind of guesswork what was going on sort of for most of these pieces of media that you found archived?
Some of them were easier than others. It really depended on the documentation. I believe this particular advertisement, it was, I'm listening to it right now. It was a Valentine's dance. Saturday, February 15th. Hmm. No, this particular recording we found was completely unlabeled, so I have no We actually showed it to Emilio, and he said he had no idea, if I recall correctly. But let me see if he had an estimate.
So, do you find the fact that some of these events, like the ballroom dates, not having any year mark, will be a problem in the future for documentation of this sort of things? I'm talking from here going forwards in time, from the year 2021, where everything is recorded and naturally bookmarked. How hard do you think it will be to categorize just the mass quantity of data that we have for events like this to historically document that these things did happen? Or do you think this art will kind of fall by the wayside because there is too much?
I don't necessarily think that it will fall by the wayside. I think that just because we don't know where it came from doesn't mean that it stops becoming important. All right. Mm-hmm. If not to us, then to at least the Turners and the National Registry and all of the Turners around the world, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, it is a shame that such things weren't so well documented, and I'm sure that's why MSOE is teaching us the importance of documentation in these software classes. But, you know, it's not like we can turn back the past. I think, mm-hmm. you know, and I think in any case, we either would have to guess or lie in the worst case, or, you know, just accept that this was something in the past, just like anything else.
Fair enough. As a computer scientist, I know one of the most major topics in computer science, broadest subject regions, is data science in particular. Do you think there is such a thing as too much documentation, too much data? No, that was the end of my question.
Okay. I think asking the question of too much documentation is different from asking the question of too much data. Mm-hmm. So, is there a particular way you wanted me to interpret that?
Let's go with what is the difference, first of all, between
sure.
too much documentation and too much data?
Sure. Well, you know, from a software perspective, documentation, I guess, is...
Oh, I guess we're going to commercial. John, get commercial.
Sorry. How can I help you? Hey, if they're not up there, can you send them up there, please? Okay, thank you.
And we're back. Mr. Fung, are you here? I assume you are.
I am here. I did not realize that was my cue. I apologize.
It is good. That was very abrupt. There was rough waves coming into the ship, and we had to deal with them. So, going back, I just asked the maybe very, very large very, very large question of what is the difference between too much data and too much documentation? And that's where we left off. So, Mr. Fung.
Yeah. So, I guess if we were to make an analogy here, I think I would compare documentation to metadata, I guess. Data about the data, in this case, it's how do you use something. And in that regard, I don't think there is such a thing. I shouldn't say that. I think there is probably such a thing as too much documentation, but I think you would have to like actively try and make bad documentation for you to ever reach that point. Let me tell you, I love Stack Overflow as much as the next software engineer here, but I would also appreciate having good documentation to fall back on. I guess compared to data, that's just... I guess in machine learning, we describe data as observations, what we call it. So I guess in that regard, that would be in the analogy, just the actual data. The things you know or have recorded.
Mm-hmm.
And in that regard, that is much more clear-cut, and that definitely can have too much data. In machine learning, in fact, there is such a thing as the curse of dimensionality, where you can't have data that is too high-dimensional and as such becomes extremely inefficient to work with. And there are ways that we, reduce dimensions and compress the data, and it's all super cool, but, you know. This isn't class.
Fair enough. However, some people might be interested, so would you like to at least go more in depth into some of those compression techniques, if you could even begin to describe them on a surface level?
Yeah, on a surface level, I definitely could. Although, once again, like, machine learning's a junior level class, right? You need to understand linear algebra, multivariable calculus, and all that for any of it to like really make sense. But I can try my hardest to explain it in layman's terms.
Mm-hmm.
So as an example, right? Let's suppose our data is an image.
Okay.
We have an image, and the image in this case has four channels: red, green, blue, and the grayscale channel. If we're trying to recognize digits, for example, we don't really care about the color of the image. We really only care about like the grayscale version of the image, because all that color just adds extra noise that doesn't really add anything to. Our analysis. Whether like a zero is in green or blue or red, doesn't make it any more or less of a zero. So in that regard, the curse of dimensionality there would be the extra color channels.
Mm-hmm.
And likewise, if we need something in color, the grayscale channel is redundant because we can make, there's a formula. If you're taking software development too, you'll be working with an image editor lab, and there's a formula to make an image grayscale. So the grayscale channel is also redundant, and you would remove it in that case. So one of the main algorithms we use to reduce dimensions is called principal component analysis. Now let me just make it clear before I keep going, all right? I love math. I love math a lot. That's another reason why I'm a CS, and I enjoy math. And in another life, if I didn't enjoy eating so much, I would have been a math major. So what we try did you say something, Jackson?
I said me too.
Yeah.
And just continue.
Yeah. So, principal component analysis. What it does is that given a set of data with a bunch of dimensions, we're going to try and keep the dimensions that provide the most information about a data set. Right? So let's take, for example, a set of digits, right? You have like a picture of a bunch of handwritten digits. If we were to remove dimensions from it, it probably wouldn't be the dimensions, the pixels. Well, I'm getting a little ahead of myself. For pictures, let's assume each pixel is a dimension, right? And it's a color between like 0 and whatever representing the grayscale channel. You know, how dark or light is it?
Mm-hmm.
Principal component analysis allows us to determine which of the pixels provide the most information and then remove the ones that have the least. For example, okay, the pixels on the edges, right, probably don't matter at all. No one's writing, for the purposes of this one, no one's writing their numbers like off to the side or in the top right corner or anything like that. They're probably going to be just solid white. Once you get to the center, you're going to have a bunch of, those are going to have a lot of information because people usually write in the center of, you know, whatever they're writing in. Is that, you with me so far, Jackson?
Yes, that makes quite a lot of sense.
Yes, that would make quite a lot of sense. So if we have all this information we don't care about, I mean, we love Rosie, right? But we want to treat her well. And NVIDIA did not give us a nice new building just for us to waste Rosie computational power to work with data that just doesn't matter. So what principal component analysis does is, given a set of data, it does some very cool linear algebra multivariable calculus to calculate what the most important and least important dimensions are, and then allows you to find a new data set with those removed vectors, or with those removed dimensions, I should say, that still contains as much of the data as possible given compression. Now,
all right,
when you think of... what were you saying, Jackson?
All right, so... could you equate this to essentially removing the outliers of too much excess of the data? So things at the edges, you're looking for things where you assume it's least likely to have the most important data. In these formulas?
I guess in a general sense, you could say that. Well, technically, machine learning is supposed to be generalizable. So that's where I agree with you there. But we can't generalize. When you run this algorithm, you run it on a data set whose values you know, right? Like, you have a set of a bunch of handwritten zeros. And if your data set's good enough, then yes, it should generalize, and I would agree. If your data set's really bad, then probably not. Does that make sense?
Yes. And whose job is it to determine if it's good or bad?
Ah, well, that's really where data science comes in. And I have not taken data science, so I can only speak to this at a cursory level. But machine learning is the theory of, like, AI, right? And data science is the application. If I were to have taken that class, at least according to Dr. Bacovey, we would be going more into the application, things such as how you collect data instead of using toy data sets given to you. How do you process data so that it's ready for you to analyze? And what does it mean to have good or bad quality data? Which in this case, you know, could mean that the data isn't representative of your population, for example. Think statistics. And so on and so forth. But I wish I could talk about it more. I really do, because it seems super interesting.
Well, you will be, presumably. And
I really hope so.
On a different note. We got really, really far off track from the honors program discussion.
That's a statement I might agree with, yes.
Yeah, but wrapping it back around to that, what qualities and what actions do you think you did really qualified you to be an RA? Because last year, there were 81 candidates. And 81, wow, from what I heard. And of those 81, I think maybe half made it to the first stage of interviews even.
I heard it was much higher at like 125. But maybe I'm sure neither of us are exactly right.
Mm-hmm.
In any case, I trust your number more than mine. So that makes me feel a little worse. I really thought I fought through 125 people, but I guess not. So thanks. But in all seriousness, you're saying like half the people didn't even make it through like the initial screening where you filled out an application and wrote that little essay?
So I've heard.
So you've heard. That's crazy. Wow, it would be... I mean, that's a tough answer. I guess... Well, with respect to the screening, I think I did come in strong with a lot of leadership.
Back to commercial.
...601.
Go ahead.
You're listening to 101.1 FM, WJEV.
Milwaukee's Classic Country, 10-4. Thank you.
Hey, John P.
Started playing the banger.
Yeah, we started playing a banger.
Shame.
Anyways, I have heard much before we started talking, and quite frankly, I'm just going to ask you about this because I don't even really remember what was going on before I got that rough interruption. Those rough waves coming in, if you catch my drift. If you sail my sea.
I'm sailing your sea.
Anyway. John, I have heard you have been instrumental in founding the Milwaukee School of Engineering Club's fencing team, or reestablishing it, at least?
I'm not certain if instrumental is the right word. Apparently, they had been dormant for the entirety of last year, but they still existed, they just weren't communicating with us. So, you know, if you weren't talking with us for literally... Who's us?
Yes.
The MSOE community, I should say.
Got it.
Yeah. So, you know, a lot of clubs were hit by COVID, and, you know, maybe Fencing Club was first on the chopping block, and I can completely understand that. But I literally had not heard from them for a year, right? And if a friend of mine did not go and physically see them at the org fair, I would have thought they would have been dead. Because they certainly did not advertise themselves. But it appears that they were just in contingency, or whatever the case may have been, and they are back and ready to get fighting. So yeah, I don't know if I was instrumental in resurrecting it per se, but I really do hope I've been generating interest, because I think it's a great sport.
They were in hiding beneath the waves.
Yeah, they feared me, I guess.
Is the fencing team any division? Or is it a club sport? So not NCAA division.
It's currently a club sport. It's not divisioned. No.
Mm-hmm. I don't even know if that's the proper terming. I think it is.
You think I know what sports are, dude? No, I have no idea. But my understanding, it's like, you know, a club. It's not anything like official or competitive.
Mm-hmm. How does one get into fencing? Just wondering. Because like you said, it's not your average sport.
Yeah, so that's a very good question. And honestly, the easiest way to get into fencing is to join a club. The idea of a fencing club is something that like actually exists in real life, right? We're not special by just being a club and not being divisioned, quote unquote, although it means something different in college. So if you did want to get into a fencing club, really you just have to go out there and look. I know, for example, while the fencing club was down last year, I actually joined Caliburn Fencing Club. They're in Plymouth Church on UWM's campus. And that's where I did one of their sessions. And that's where I got started in fencing. So, you know, if the fencing club were to die again, and I hope it doesn't, I would totally recommend just going out into the area and looking for fencing clubs, because they are there. But if the club doesn't die, then, well, we've got one right here.
So, is fencing more of a hobbyist sport than anything else? Because it's certainly not widely advertised, yet it's still in the Olympics, and I'm pretty sure if you go up to just about anyone, they'll know what fencing is. It's kind of like boxing in that aspect. People have wanted to cut or punch each other since the dawn of time. So people know what the sport is, but not many people practice it. Do you find that interesting?
I do find it a little interesting. And I, what you said about people wanting to cut each other since the dawn of time, it makes me want to talk about the history of fencing, because I think it's super interesting. But to answer your question, clearly it's at least a little mainstream, right? Although maybe not as big as, say, the footballs or the basketballs. But I definitely would not consider it to be a hobbyist sport in the sense that it isn't developed. Because you are right, it is the Olympics. My instructor at Caliburn Fencing Club, David Neville, he's like a grandmaster of fencing, and he went to like adjudicate a fencing tournament in Pennsylvania during one of our sessions. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, to say that it's hobbyist, I don't think would be completely accurate. Sure, maybe it's not as popular, but you'd be lying to yourself if you didn't, like, take a branch as a child and try to hit someone with it.
And going back, I think that is a great segue into what is the history of fencing?
Oh, the history of fencing. All right, well, I haven't given enough lectures this episode.
Mm-hmm.
So, we got to go back to the medieval era for this.
Okay.
Right. In the military, on the battlefield, right, you'd have these big, bulky knights in these, like, very thick plate armor. Mm-hmm. And how do you deal with that? Well, you've got these really big swords and these great axes, and you got two hands, and you swing them overhead, and you try and cut their limbs off or whatever, right?
Mm-hmm.
In the civilian defense world, that's not really necessary. So obviously, civilians during that time weren't wearing full plate armor like the knights, nor could they probably even afford such a thing. It just wasn't happening. And as such, civilian defense came more to be about speed and accuracy than it did raw power. You're no longer breaking through plate armor, you're trying to break through, like, someone's just normal clothes. So with that in mind, the first weapon, and the one that most beginners start with, the foil, is literally just a blade with a point at the end. It's very light and very quick. If you were to get attacked, say, on the street for whatever reason, right, you can pull it out quickly and you can attack and defend quickly. Now, of course, in that time period also came duels. So fencing wasn't just something that happened. People were studying formally the art of fencing to not only protect themselves but their honor if they were to be caught out in a street or challenged to a duel. Now, with that, because these were duels, right, back then these were life and death situations, which inspired some of the rules that fencing has today. For example, with the foil, the only way to score is to hit someone in the upper chest region. If you, in a duel, right, you wouldn't try to aim for someone's leg because you'd want to hit them in the chest and incapacitate them and hopefully come out with your life. The same idea goes for the right-of-way rules. Fencing has right-of-way, which means that if two opponents hit each other at the same time, there's a process to determine who gets the point. And now these right-of-way rules, they're like conceptually pretty obvious. If someone attacks and you try and attack them as they're attacking you, the attacker has the right of way. You should try and block their attack. And once again, that goes back to dueling. If someone's attacking you, you're not going to try and attack them back because you need to block their attack or you get stabbed and you die.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so, and that's something my instructor taught me, and hopefully when I teach fencing club, wink, wink, nudge, nudge, starting next week, hopefully that'll make, like, some of the ideas behind fencing easier to understand. So from there, we... Oh.
Have you already been approved to be an instructor at fencing club?
Yeah, so actually, one of my residents lives with the president of fencing club. Him and I are... You know, we're definitely getting closer with the whole fencing club thing, and hopefully I will be able to teach. My understanding is that I have been approved, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Cool. I guess there's a little
awesome
bit more I can keep
hear.
Going. If you... Yeah, I know.
Yeah, go ahead. Yeah,
sure.
Keep going.
Oh, heck yeah. So the foil, a point. The saber is like the foil, but it also has a blade, so you can swing with it. And that means the target region is now the upper chest and the arms, because you can hack someone's arm off.
Mm-hmm.
As fencing came about, you know, it would keep going, keep going, keep going, until about the 20th century. At that point, dueling was out of style. People weren't really pulling up to each other on the street and, like, trying to stab each other with swords, nor were duels legal. Society really didn't want people killing each other over, you know, anything. Anything that wasn't settled between them and, like, the government, right?
Mm-hmm.
So to that end, the fencing changed with the advent of the épée. Well, it was a sword that came up around that time, but the rules of épée are really what manifests. During that time, because you couldn't kill each other, you went to first blood. The épée was just the sword of choice for the time period, but the target region now becomes your entire body, reflecting, you know, that rule of first blood.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so, I mean, I think, like, for example, military and combat, like, history is very interesting. And take, for example, this is something my instructor told me, right? We have all these Roman shields and spears that we found, like, scattered around Italy, but there's no recordings of how they use them. So how do we use mm-hmm. them? We literally just picked, well, not we as in I, but, you know, professionals took them, examined them, and try to make them work. And I think that fencing is just an extension of that elegance, that grace, and that skill, you know, to the modern era, without us killing each other. Yeah, so that's the abridged history anyway. Yeah.
I do have one question. You mentioned foil and épée. What about saber? Isn't saber a form of fencing?
Yeah, did I? I did mention saber. It was the one you could slash with.
Oh, so sorry. Yes. So, yes. Sorry, I misheard you.
Yeah, no worries.
Not saber. What is it?
Rapier?
No, not rapier. I'm not as skilled as fencing knowledge as you are, so I'm going to move on.
All right. I mean, do you want to try describing it? Or?
No, it's not. Oh, I know what I'm... Never mind. Keep moving on. Back to fencing club. I know what I'm thinking of. It's nothing related to fencing whatsoever.
I know that sounds weird.
No, I don't want to share.
Okay, I understand. No worries. All right.
I kind of have to now for the sake of entertainment, but I was thinking of the martial kendo, is it? Which is the Japanese style of sort of the same concept, from what I understand.
It's... I'm not that familiar with kendo, but I mean...
Neither am I.
I mean, it is the same fundamental ideas of, like, swordsmanship and, you know, mm-hmm. combat. So I would... Yeah, I would...
I was going to ask about its evolution, but then I was like, wait a second, that's not fencing at all.
It is not fencing. I can't say it is, yeah.
Imposter. I was like, no, stop. Okay. Getting back off of that tangent, do you think people avoid fencing? Because, as you said, you know, there are very, very particular regions that each fencing art can hit. Like you said, foil can only hit upper chest, saber extends a little bit more to the arms, and then épée is first blood, so anywhere. Do you think there's some hesitation to join fencing because of fear of injury at all?
I personally did not have this fear. I mean, like, if you've seen the protective equipment we wear, it's like four layers, and it gets really hot in there, but you're safe. But I can't blame anyone for thinking that way, because, I mean, it's not pleasant getting, you know, hit by the sword. Definitely not. So in that regard, I mean, sure, yeah, like trying anything else new, I can understand that.
Oh, updates from Mr. Senator John Shields III from earlier in the podcast. Apparently, the birds are being taken care of somewhat already by the student government. They're actually doing stuff.
How so?
Isn't that neat? Yeah, if he's listening, which I don't think he is right now, or he's in the ship and he's listening to us on the frequency 101.1 FM, he may be able to actually tell us how the birds are being taken care of. I don't think he is, though. I think he's just ghosting in the chat.
Sure.
So, that's good news, at least. How do you manage to get your protective equipment? Is it just, not even your protective equipment, but your own swords and such? I know you join a club, but after the point where you go, yeah, I've enjoyed the club, but I would like my own equipment, sort of in the same vein of any professional sport where you go, yes, I've been using the clubs for a while, but I really want my own bowling ball, or I really want my own bat, and, you know, stuff like that. Where do you go to even consider purchasing, like, a saber or a foil?
Oh, sure. Yeah, so, you know this, but one of the other RAs, Ryan Nickel, found a wooden foil at Goodwill. It really is that easy.
Mm-hmm.
But in all seriousness, there are actual, like, vendors and places to buy fencing equipment from. That isn't just Amazon, right?
Yeah.
My instructor recommended, like, five places. We have, like, AbsoluteFencingGear.com, BlueGauntlet.com, and, you know, there are a bunch of places where you can get it from that, well, at least I trust my instructor, anyway, that I would consider to be reputable. I really don't think it's that bad if you want to just fence on your own, but the electric equipment, you probably don't want to buy that yourself. That's definitely a, like, the scoring equipment is definitely something you'd want to go to a club for.
Yes. You wouldn't buy your own bowling alley if you were a professional bowler or something.
No,
like
you would
that.
Not.
Yes.
No. And I mean, I guess you could if you really want, if you really had some beef to settle, but yeah, you really shouldn't.
Have you gone to any, I know you've had a few bouts already, and I know you won your first bout very close to when you came back to Milwaukee. Have you gone to any regional or even national events? Just to even spectate yet?
Just, I wish I could say I could have, but I have not. The biggest event I'd say would be the Caliber and, like, the final session tournament that we had. That would be the biggest event. But sadly, I couldn't even come to that because I was, because of RA training.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I mean, I would definitely love to in the future, but you know, I don't claim to be, like, anything more than an amateur at fencing. But I definitely know enough to, like, teach people the fundamentals, right?
Yes.
I definitely want to further my study. If not now, then, you know, hey, maybe over the summer again with Caliburn or whoever I decide to go with. But in any case, I think even like the fundamentals of fencing, right, is really all you need to at least get started and have a good time.
Yes. In that note, what is the average age of people who are fencing? Is it older people? Is it younger people? Like, what's the demographic? Because sometimes some sports, let's say football, you just really can't do it. Like, even past middle age, it gets very, very dangerous and rough to do it.
Yeah.
As compared to a sport like, I don't know, you have things like golf where people can play up until they die.
Yeah, so fencing is definitely not golf or playing an instrument. You probably don't want to do it once you're, once you get like that old, I guess, because it is a physical sport. However, according to the United States Fencing Association, anyway, right? The largest group, 42%, is under 20. One quarter is over 40. So. This is definitely something you can do for a good, you know, majority of your life, if you really wanted to. The demographics, this isn't the sport you can do forever, probably, but you can definitely do it for a long time.
Mm-hmm. Certainly won't also, in most cases, won't put you out of commission either.
No, absolutely not. I've heard stories of, you know, the ends of foils coming off and ripping through the protective equipment, but, you know, they certainly did not die. They didn't die. I don't even think they got injured. I think the equipment stopped it. But in any case, you can... I strongly believe that, you know, fencing is safe. I don't think there's any reason you should be scared of it once you get used to getting poked through the armor a couple of times.
Well, even back then, we're going back to your history lesson of the medieval ages, the giant suits of armor that they had, you know, there's this misconception in most modern fantasy that things can just cut through armor like it's butter if it's made out of, like, the same material, like, steel can just glance through steel like it's nothing, but the reality is to puncture proper armor, like proper plate, was basically basically nearly impossible. So even back then... Oh, what were you going to say?
You can keep going. I'll say it at the end.
I kind of was at the end. I was like, it's nearly impossible to puncture through the armor. That's why medieval tactics came up with weapons like the Warhammer that could deal bludgeoning damage and concave the armor instead of just, you know, trying to slash or dab through it. And, you know, there's obviously specific joints in the armor that could be stabbed through, but that was extremely difficult to do in a actual bout.
Absolutely. I guess let me make it clear as well, right? That is kind of sort of a misconception. But like, knights aren't stupid, right? Like, it's not as if people were using swords because they sucked. They were definitely the best at the time, and while they were bad against, like, plate,
they were economically efficient because most people didn't have plates.
Yeah, against unarmored opponents, I would agree. People use swords because they were just simply, like, more versatile, right? Like, there's a reason why people weren't all using great hammers and maces against armored opponents, even though there is that misconception of what was actually used on the battlefield. The military history again, but...
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, in any case, those things really just weren't particularly effective at all, but it was the best they had until, you know, the English longbow came around.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then... English longbow was replaced by the musket, because why would you need to train people how to use a bow when you just simply point and shoot, and then get better at pointing and shooting?
Yeah, well, you should tell my CS teams that, dude.
Your CS team?
Yeah. Tell the CS team, you know. Tell the Valorant team, get better at pointing and shooting.
Get better at pointing and shooting.
Yeah. No,
I've
but I mean, you're
touched Valorant. I have to be honest.
Don't ever touch a Riot game. It's not healthy for you, all right?
Yes, I'm quite aware. But I've also, I'm on the Jackson Detterbeck train of thought of, if you're going to touch one of those crack games, make it Dota or a Valve game with a semi-decent business model.
Yeah, well, yeah, if you had to pick up one, you know, make it Dota, make it CS, don't make it, you know, Valorant or League of Legends.
What are your thoughts on, I know this is, we don't have a lot of time left. Really quick, as our last thing we're going to talk about, what do you think about League or Valorant's business model of you have to purchase champions or just spend money to pay to win games, essentially? What are your thoughts on pay to win games?
I'm certain my opinion is that of the majority, and that pay-to-win games suck. I hate pay-to-win games. I hate the predatory monetization practices like loot boxes and gacha and all that, you know. And I.
But then just, why do people play them still?
They're addictive. I mean, let's just put it simply. They're addictive, right?
Mm-hmm.
Those predatory practices like loot boxes and gacha, they're addicting. That's why they're using them. That's why casinos use them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I wish I could tell you why people play League of Legends. I could tell you why I played League of Legends. My friends played League of Legends, you know, but I just wish people would stop playing League of Legends. I wish they could see that they're addicted or maybe they're just masochists or whatever the case, right? But I just don't think those games are. I really don't have a good history with them. I really don't like them. And
have you ever heard of the story that there's no clocks inside of most casinos because they want to keep you there and they don't want you to know what time of day it is?
I have not heard that story, but I absolutely believe it.
I'm not sure if it's one of those urban myths, but from what I've been told, most casinos are designed that their main game rooms and, you know, your main area in any casino, your blackjack tables, don't have any windows or clocks to basically keep them in there and not be able to tell what time of day it is. And Valve recently took this and they removed the built-in digital clock from the home screen of Dota 2. It just disappeared. It used to be in the top right. It would used to say 10:30 p.m. if it was 10:30 p.m. and it's gone now.
Yeah, I mean, there are Reddit threads talking about the clock. Yeah.
Yeah. Did you just look it up as I was saying?
I did just look it up, and that's so true. Okay, I did not know that. That's crazy.
Yeah, so, beware, viewers, as a final warning, if you learned anything from this episode on any of our tangents, be aware of game companies and sports companies trying to remove clocks that keep you in the casino. I mean, if it's detrimental to your health, beware of it, but obviously fencing's not going to hurt you.
I really hope not. We're going to have issues.
Really hope.
I mean, if you put on your equipment, then you wouldn't have an issue. So, yeah, so thank you very much for having me. I hope I will see some of you at Fencing Club 6 to 7 Thursdays at the Kern. I know you guys want to stab me, so please, please come.
questions for Mr. Fung before we hang up. And by anyone, I probably just mean the one viewer in our Discord call and anyone else listening anywhere else.
Mr. John Fungarino, you said you were in the fencing. Which fencing do you like better, chain link or picket?
Probably have to be picket. I'm not a big fan of the aesthetic of chain link. I'm going to be real with you there.
That's understandable.
Okay, well, I'm glad I made
just,
the right choice.
I was just wondering, as a fencing enthusiast, isn't the yard fences?
No, of course. Thank you for asking.
Mr. Fung, do you think you can get hurt fencing? Not the way we were talking about, but other fencing.
The other fencing? You can definitely get hurt doing the other fencing. Well, why do you think I don't do it? I don't do it because it's unsafe. Actual fencing's safer than fencing.
You heard it here first, folks. Fence. Don't fence. And that will probably be it for tonight. Thank you, everyone that listened both here and people that are listening in post to Smooth Sailing on WJEB Radio 101.1 FM, Milwaukee's finest country music. We are now going to announce the guests for next week. No, we're not, because we have no idea who it is.
Yay.
Yay.
Yeah. Thank you very much again. I hope that the guest next week will be into fencing as much as I am.
Yes, and thank you for being here, Mr. Jonathan Fungarino.
Yo, what's the outro music now that we
it's
changed?
It's gonna
the
be
intro
a
music?
Long night. Wait for the first night. It's gonna be a long, long, long night. We never made the outro music over the summer. We just forgot to do it.
We were gonna make outro music? Shit.
Yeah. We can edit this all out.
Are we still live? Can't we just play the intro again?
No, we had a song. I just forget what it is.
Okay,
cool. Do you want to just put on the old theme music and have that be the outro?
No, we had one. It's going to be a long night, remember?
Yeah, it's going to
what was it called?
Be a long night. Well, it's a song by Ween, but I don't think that's what you want.
You know, we can just do it in post. And by us, I mean, Milky can just do it in post.
I think we should just use the, I'll just put on the music from Pat Boone, and then we could use that as the outro music, because it'll make everybody leave. Or stick around and listen to more of Milwaukee's finest classic country, only on WJEB 101.1.
By the way, Mitch, that SpongeBob music you were playing, slap. I don't know what it was, but like, wow.
Dick, should we like, play the outro or like the interim outro music now?
No, I think we should just keep talking.
Yeah, we can pad until 8 o'clock.
We can pad if we want. We do a little padding. Oh no, I think I have COVID.
Guess you get a promotion to Grovin Towers.
Oh yeah, now I get more money per square foot.
Hold up, I have the most meta, like, interview questions.
Yeah?
Mr. John Fung,
yes,
who
sir.
Do you think we should have for a guest next week?
Who do I think you should have for a guest next week? Oh.
Yeah.
I think D would make a great guest.
Yeah, we could probably do that.
The ginger one or the not ginger one?
What?
The one that gets confused with Brighton, probably.
Yeah. That'd be a good idea.
I definitely think he's got a lot to talk about.
I think we should get Dr. Meyer on.
I would love to have you have Dr. Carrier on. Oh, or Dr. Bacovey.
Oh, I didn't mean to post that.
What did you just post?
I just posted the Smooth Sailing theme song in Mage's meme Discord.
What about, Oh, we got Sean Jones.
Prof Jones? Let's, dude, if you got him on, that'd be great.
It's like, I think he's the only, as far as I know, he's one of the only professors here who plays in a Rush tribute band. If I remember right, I heard that somewhere.
He does play in a Rush tribute band, and you can actually, like, find his concerts online, dude. He is a Giga Chad. Like, there's no other way to put it.
The man has a degree from, like, MATC and became, like, he was like, that's not good enough. He got a fucking, he became an instructor or something. I have
respect
for that man.
Well, he has a degree from Milwaukee.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or UW Milwaukee.
Hey, Mitch, guess what? I found the outro.
Hooray.
So little people requested songs during the summer that it was just there.
Well, we weren't broadcasting during the summer.
Fair enough. Anyways, I'm going to end it now. Thanks, everyone. Bye.
Don't forget to tune in next week for Smooth Sailing 2 at 6 o'clock on Saturday. Who we're interviewing is a surprise, even to us. Waiting for the first light.